Hello, listeners. Jordan here. I just want to let you know that you can listen to Nighttime early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Include it with Prime.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
According to the police officer I spoke to, they went through a list of questions in order to ascertain whether or not she was safe and determined that she was okay to be on her own on the streets of Victoria barefoot in November. And they left her there. That was the last time anyone ever saw her.
You are listening to Emma Filipoff is Missing, a series by the Nighttime Podcast.
Filled with mystery and heartbreak, this series will be as much about the strength of a mother's love as it will be about the fragility of the human mind. Over the course of an 8-episode series, we're going to explore the disappearance of 26-year-old Emma Filipoff, who was last seen by the police officers who left her standing barefoot on a busy intersection in Victoria, British Columbia, on a cold night in November of 2012. For the last 7 years, Emma's story has been the focus of investigation by people approaching it from all sides. The police, the private investigators, the armchair detectives, journalists, and of course, nearly endless podcasters. The story of Emma Filipoff is easily among Canada's most often discussed missing persons cases. Now, despite all the work done related to Emma's disappearance, none of it has brought us any closer to finding her. And as I said, many have tried. But there is one person whose efforts have been simply staggering. In fact, even if one were to compile all the investigators' and storytellers' work, it would pale in comparison to that of the woman who has dedicated her life to solving the mystery that surrounds Emma's disappearance. I'm referring, of course, to Emma's mother, Shelley Filipoff. Tragically, Shelley seemed to be just beyond arm's reach of Emma in the days leading up to her disappearance. From Shelley's point of view, it all starts with a series of disturbing phone calls from Emma requesting help with some vague personal crisis. After Emma goes back and forth on if she would like her mother to fly to Emma's city of Victoria, British Columbia to support her, Shelley begins to realize that something is seriously wrong, and she decides to make the trip anyway, hoping simply to check on her daughter's well-being. In a cruel twist, Shelley arrived in Victoria on November 28, 2012, the last night Emma was seen, and the night she was reported missing. As we will soon hear, Shelley Filipoff has been on a relentless search for her missing daughter ever since.
Shelley Filipoff is following up on every lead, desperately searching for her daughter Emma, missing since November 28th. Emma moved to Victoria from Ottawa in September 2011. In the days before she went missing, Shelley got a number of calls from her distraught daughter, asking her to come out and help her move back to Ontario. But within hours, Emma would call back, telling Shelley not to come. But mother's intuition told her she needed to. Without telling her daughter, Shelley boarded a plane. When she got to Victoria, Emma was gone. She'd left just hours earlier.
I personally became aware of this case after watching the CBC-produced documentary, Finding Emma. I happened upon it nearly by accident, flipping through the channels on a quiet Sunday night. But before I even realized it, I had found myself drawn into Emma's story, and I wanted to learn as much as I could. As far as why I became so interested in this story, it's hard to say, but I'm sure a lot of it had to do with Emma. It was something about her that reminded me of many friends that I have. And then there was her mom, Shelley. On screen, she seemed so genuine and relatable. But on top of that, at the time that I was first watching the documentary, I was a new dad, and the thought of being in Shelley's shoes was just something I couldn't even imagine. These feelings within me left me unable to look away from the case. I wanted to understand all I could about Emma and about the circumstances that relate to her disappearance. And that's really where this series started, with a need to understand how people like the ones I know and love can find themselves in this unimaginable situation. And the first step towards this goal was connecting with Emma's mother, Shelley, and inviting her to share her story with listeners of Nighttime. And that's what we're going to get into shortly. Tonight, on this episode of Nighttime, we will begin the Emma Filipov is Missing series by speaking with the force behind the search for Emma, her mother, Shelley Filipov.
Well, Emma's personality is simply lovely. She's compassionate, she's kind, she's creative, she's talented, she's intelligent, she's funny. People are very drawn to her because she just has that type of personality that makes you want to get to know her. She's an animal lover, she's an advocate for the underdog. She's just an all-around lovely person, and I know that sounds like a mother speaking, and it is a mother speaking, but people that know Emma, who have even just met Emma briefly, become quickly aware of exactly what this young woman has to offer the world.
And it seems like everybody who met her and got to know her was drawn to her. Why do you think it is that people are so drawn to Emma?
She draws people to her because she's non-judgmental. She takes you for who you are at face value. She doesn't have expectations. She doesn't set expectations upon you. She doesn't want you to be somebody you're not. And people feel at ease with someone who knows that they're not being judged when they meet someone new.
And a lot's been said about her interest in art, being a writer and a photographer. Could you just talk about her interest in art and how that developed over the years?
Well, Emma was always interested in art. She was always doodling and drawing, and of course her father is an artist, so it attracted her even more. But we didn't actually see a lot of artwork coming from Emma until she hit her teenage years. And then she really started developing her creative talents and became interested in photography as well.
Interesting. Prior to Emma moving to Victoria, can you just describe where she was at in her life, like when she was living in Perth for that period of time?
Yeah, she was living in Perth. She was living with her dad. She had come home from the West Coast because she has a congenital knee problem, and she wanted to see her own orthopedic surgeon. So that was initially the reason she came home. Once she got home, she realized she wanted to stay around for a while, which she did. So she let go of her position in Campbell River, where she was a chef at one of the local pubs. And so she stayed in Perth, and she essentially just hung out. She did a lot of drawing, a lot of painting, a lot of photography, spent time with friends that she hadn't seen for a long time, and that kind of thing.
Great. And now, can you describe Emma's decision to move to Victoria? And maybe as well tell me about when she initially arrived, what she was doing there and what her plan was.
Well, her plan was to return to the West Coast. She loves the West Coast. So her plan eventually was to return. And she really debated. She wasn't sure where on the West Coast she would go. She knew she would go to BC. She didn't want to go back to Campbell River. So she just, I think, kind of arbitrarily chose Victoria. And she went without a job. She went in the hopes of finding something when she got there.
Was she in touch with her friends and family back home while she was in Victoria? And can you talk about the type of communication her friends and family and yourself would have had with her while she was living in Victoria?
Emma was primarily in touch via email. She was not a believer in technology per se, so she absolutely refused to have a cell phone. So she didn't have a cell phone, which made it very, very difficult for her to get a hold of us by phone. She'd have to use a pay phone to call. So she tended to stay in touch via emails. So she emailed friends and she emailed us, and I'd say she emailed me at least once a month. So her emails were always light and airy. Some were even cryptic, many of them poetic, not your standard email. When I look back on them now, I see that there were messages there that I would never have been able to pick up on at the time. I see them now, but at the time they just seemed poetic and somewhat cryptic, but very, very beautiful and very poetic and very happy. The tone of every email was happy, definitely happy.
Now, can you tell me about what initially led you to be concerned for Emma while in Victoria? And what I'm looking at here is the phone calls that she made to you, as well as your discovery of her staying at the Sandy Merriman.
Well, I received a phone call on a Friday evening. Friday night, late actually. It was almost early Saturday morning. It was around midnight, and Emma called, and she was in tears and telling me that she wanted to come home. She was very distressed, so I didn't want to further distress her by asking her questions, so I didn't ask her what was wrong. I just said, well, absolutely, you know, of course you can come home. What I'll do is I will go in to my laptop and book you a knee ticket, and it'll be waiting for you at the airport, and just hop on a plane and then come home, and we'll meet you at the airport, and then we'll go from there. And she cried even harder and seemed to become more distressed and asked that I come to Victoria to help her come home. She said she wasn't in any shape to travel on her own or to pack up her things and come home on her own. So that was the initial phone call. So I said that I would book a ticket then, and that I would be there within roughly 12 hours. I figured by the time I booked my ticket, organized things here and packed and got to the airport, I'm an hour from the airport, I figured, I said, it'll be a good 12 hours, but I will be there on Saturday for sure, Emma. So that seemed to appease her a bit, and we talked a little bit longer, and I said, you know, let me know when you want to hang up, whenever you're ready to end this conversation. I said, if you want to stay on the phone all night, that's fine. So she calmed down somewhat. She was still sobbing, but she calmed down and she said, okay, so I will see you for sure tomorrow. And I said, absolutely, I'll see you tomorrow, which was Saturday. Saturday morning, mid-morning, I got a phone call from Emma, again distraught, but not in tears so much, saying, I've changed my mind, I was just having a bad day, I think I can handle things on my own, I think I can cope, please cancel your ticket and don't come. So I proceeded to cancel my ticket. By now I'm extremely concerned. I'm talking to the other members of our family, and they're urging me to respect her last wish, which was for me not to go. I said, you know, Emma's very private, and if she's changed her mind, there's a reason for it, so don't force yourself on her. So I thought, okay, so I canceled my ticket. And then that Saturday night, I got another phone call, and it was Emma, and she was very distressed, and it was, please come and help me. I need help. I want to come home. So I went through the same routine. I booked a ticket and packed, and I got a ticket ready for Sunday. And again, I told her, you know, I would be roughly 12 hours to get there. And, by then Monday, I received another phone call, Jordan, and it was, don't come. It was, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to be fine. But at no time did she sound as if she were fine. Mm-hmm. She was saying she was fine, but at no point did I think, oh, yes, she's pulling it together. At no point did I think that. the last phone call. So we played phone tag, and again, I talked to the other family members. I talked to her siblings. I talked to her dad, and they said, you know, you've got to respect your privacy. And her last wish is always, don't come. So, Mom, you need to listen to that. It really went against the grain for me. It went against my gut instinct. But I put a lot of stock in my other children and knowing their sibling probably better than I might know her. Mm-hmm. So I followed their advice. By Wednesday morning, I had received the last phone call, so that would be the last time I spoke to her. And she said, don't come today. Don't come, Mom, not today. And that was the last time I spoke to her. I flew out that day and arrived in Victoria. I arrived at the airport at 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. by the time I got my luggage and got a taxi and got organized. I arrived at the Sandy Merriman Shelter for Women, which is something I had discovered during one of the phone calls, that that's where she was staying.
How did you discover that she was staying at the shelter?
Well, one of the phone calls was definitely from a phone booth because she reversed the charges, so I didn't think anything of that. And as I said, she never had a cell phone. But then the subsequent calls came from the name that would come up on call display was Sandy Merriman. And the first couple of times, I assumed that that was someone's name and that that was the person that she was living with. So it didn't. At first, it didn't occur to me to think anything of it. But on the, I think it was on the third call, I thought, I'm going to call this number back and see if I can get Emma and see if I can talk to her without having her call me. So when I called, they answered and they said this was the Sandy Merriman Shelter for Women. And I was just in shock. I didn't have any idea that Emma had been staying at a woman's shelter. So I was overwhelmed. I was really overwhelmed to find out that that's where she had been staying.
Mm-hmm. And when you arrived at Victoria, I understand you went directly to the Sandy Merriman shelter. Can you tell me about your arrival there and how that played out?
Well, I arrived at 11 p.m. They let me in and I explained who I was and they said, we're sorry, Emma's not here. And I was very disappointed, but I wasn't overly surprised. Really, my feeling was one of disappointment. So I said, any idea where she is? And they said, no, she's missed curfew. She's missed the chance at her bed, so she's probably staying at a friend's house. So again, I was extremely disappointed. But then the supervisor suggested that we go up to her office and that we talk. So then some bells went off, and I thought, okay, so it's not just the fact that Emma's staying over at a friend; something else is going on here. So she took me to her office, and she went on to explain that Emma hadn't been herself for the last 2 weeks, and they had been extremely concerned about her. And I explained about the phone calls, and they said, yes, we were aware of those because all but one or two she had made from their office. And it required a staff member to be present in the office when someone was making a phone call. So they overheard the phone conversations. So we talked for about an hour. They gave me some description. They were very cautious. They were very aware of the privacy laws, so they weren't willing to tell me much. But by midnight, the supervisor thought that it would be a good idea to call the police and have her considered a missing person. Then a lot of bells went off, Jordan. Then I thought, okay, they know a lot more than they're letting on, and there's something seriously wrong here.
Now, before we get to the events of the day of Emma's disappearance, can you describe the first days and the initial search that you started, things such as where you were staying and the type of methods you were using to find information on Emma?
Well, fortunately, there was a hotel directly across the street from the shelter, so I went over there around 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and they had a room for me, so I asked for a room that overlooked the shelter, and they had one, so I took that one at the front of the hotel so that I could watch the shelter, and I thought I could actually sit on the bed and watch the front door of the shelter, and I thought, well, I can just watch. I can sit here tonight and watch to see if she does show up. Even though I'd been told that she had missed curfew and she wasn't entitled to a bed, I thought she still might show up, and surely to goodness they would let her in. They wouldn't just turn her away. So, but no such luck. She didn't turn up. So the next day I decided that I would just start walking the streets. Again, I was really surprised about assigning her the missing person title. It just never occurred to me, Jordan, that things were this bad. So I just started walking the streets. I found out from, I went back to the shelter and asked them if they knew of some of Emma's favorite spots, and they were willing to tell me that. So I started walking the streets and walking down different areas, walking along the beach, going to places, to the marina, for instance, going to all the places where Emma was known to hang out, like the public library and those places. So I did that for the first couple of days. Then I realized that it wasn't going to be a simple matter of turning a corner and seeing her. So I had no photos of her. So I went back to the shelter and asked them if they had any photographs. And by luck, they had one, because one of the things that they do is take a picture of someone when they come in. So I had one picture, so I made up a poster of that one picture, and I started postering the city of Victoria. I just plastered the city with posters. Unfortunately, the first ones we had were black and white, and the picture didn't look like Emma at all. I mean, she looked scared, and it just didn't look like her at all. But that's all I had, and I knew that I had to start getting posters up as fast as I could. That bought me some time, and then I emailed and called people and said, you know, can you forward me any recent photographs you have? These are her friends I'm talking about. Any recent photographs you may have of her, as recent as possible, preferably in color, et cetera, et cetera. So all of a sudden these pictures started pouring in, so then I could update the poster, and every few days we could make the poster better until we finally came up with one that we were happy with, and that was the one that we used. And I say we because it didn't take me very long for me to gather a small group of volunteers who were willing to help poster the city.
Great. And you know, I understand you were back and forth on the shelter trying to find ways to get information from the shelter staff. Can you talk a little bit about your technique of getting information despite the Privacy Act?
Well, the technique was fairly straightforward because I didn't have to put on an act. I was a mother in distress. Tears came easily. So I would go and talk to them and ask them what they thought might have happened, and slowly but surely ask them, you know, well, what do you mean she changed in the last little while? And they say, well, we're not supposed to talk about it. And I say, well, just off the record, if you could just give me an example of how she might have changed. Don't be specific. Don't give me, you know, times or dates. But I was, I think I came across as the person I was, which was a very vulnerable, distressed mother. And I broke down in tears every time I went to the shelter. And I think that a number of the frontline shelter staff, I think they were compassionate enough that they felt that they just needed to help me. So they did divulge things that I found out later that they should not have, and I think they were chastised for it. I know I was chastised for going to the shelter, and I was told that I was no longer welcome there. But I found out a lot about her mental state through the frontline staff at the Merriman shelter.
At this point in our discussion, Shelley is describing the early days of her search for Emma. While staying in a hotel room across the street from the women's shelter and using a nearby library as a sort of war room, Shelley will be joined by a group of locals who volunteered to assist her in the search for Emma. And, of course, for whatever breadcrumbs she may have left behind. And there were quite a few. As we will soon hear, the biggest problem with these breadcrumbs is that they seem to present more questions than they do answers. But one thing is for certain, something strange was going on in Emma
in the days leading up to her disappearance, and it all seemed to boil over on her last known day. In the upcoming segment of our discussion, we'll walk through some of the things she since learned about Emma's activity on November 28th. We'll start with Emma's morning visit to a downtown Victoria 7-Eleven convenience store. Early in the search for Emma, Shelley had learned that Emma purchased a prepaid credit card just after 8 a.m. on the morning of her disappearance. And fortunately, the 7-Eleven had the surveillance footage to prove it. When we get back to the discussion with Shelley, she'll describe that footage.
So she went in there and she purchased this prepaid credit card, which, you know, in retrospect seems odd because she had a debit card, but anyhow, she purchased it. But then she was very reluctant to leave the store. If you look at the footage, she walks back and forth and she peers out and she holds her hands up to the glass so as to block out any shadow so that she can see outside. And it looked as if she was watching for somebody, but her actions, her movements, her gestures were very nervous, seemed very tense. So I don't think she was waiting for a friend. I think she was concerned that there was somebody out there. That at least that's what I got from looking at the footage. I mean, later on, when I discovered more about her mental state, then it could have been her own way of thinking. But definitely, the vibe that I got from Emma in the store was that she was very, very nervous and she was afraid to go back outside.
Now, the next bit of footage that was been shared is at 5:54 p.m. when she returned to the same 7-Eleven now to purchase the prepaid cell phone. Can you describe that?
And again, one thing that stands out is she's buying a prepaid cell phone. She's never owned a cell phone in her life, so that makes me really question why she was buying a cell phone. And again, she's extremely hesitant to leave the store. She paces back and forth, and she looks out, and she holds her hand up again to block out shadow so that she can really see who's out there. Again, very tense, almost jittery in her movements. In her gestures. For me, knowing Emma the way I know her, Emma has a very fluid way of moving. She moves, well, she was a dancer, and she moves like a dancer. And she certainly wasn't moving like a dancer that night. She was hesitant. She seemed scared to me, Jordan. She seemed afraid.
The next activity takes place about 15 minutes later. It's the cab ride at 6:10 p.m. Can you just describe to me that course of events, starting with her getting in the cab and ending with her leaving the cab?
Okay, well, to the best of my knowledge, she hails a cab. She gets in the cab and she asks to go to the airport. She proceeds to ask the cab driver how much it'll cost to go, and he said that it would be $60. So she said, oh, that's too much, I can't afford it. Well, we since know that she got a prepaid credit card for $200 and that she had money in her bank account, so she could in fact afford it, but she says she can't. So she asks him to drop her off, but what's very bizarre is that she wants to stay in the car and go around the block and have him drop her off at exactly the point where he picked her up, which is kind of bizarre. And then when he gets to that point where he had picked her up, she doesn't want to get out of the car. She asks if she can stay and sit for a little while in the car, and he says, well, you know, I've got to work, and said, oh, if I could just stay with you, if I could just sit here for a few minutes. And then she reacts to the radio. Now, I don't know if it's the radio or his taxi radio system, but she hears something coming out, some sounds coming out, and she asks him what that is. Again, as if there seems to be some type of paranoia at play here. After a couple of minutes, he insists that, of course, that she has to get out, and she does get out of the taxi.
And now, from the time she left the cab, only a short amount of time would pass before she would encounter the acquaintance who would ultimately get the police involved. Can you describe her meeting with this acquaintance up to the point that he notifies the police?
Okay. Well, the acquaintance is a young man named Dennis Quay, and he ran into Emma and was really happy to see her. He had only met her once. Again, there's an example of how people love to be around Emma, because he had only met her once in the library, and yet when he saw her, he told me that he was just so excited to see her. He said at first she didn't seem to recognize me, and he found that odd because they had spent hours poring over books on Japan, because she was interested in traveling to Japan. I believe he was interested in learning Japanese. So they, even though they had only had that one encounter prior to this one, they had spent a number of hours together. So he was really surprised, and he said she was just so different than the Emma that he had met and spent time with in the library. So he just kind of stayed with her and tried to engage her in conversation, and eventually she asks him if he would walk with her, and he said yes, of course, and so they spent some time walking together. There was some construction outside the Empress Hotel, apparently, at that time, and they were going to walk past the Empress in that direction. But when they get to the construction, the alleyway that's been constructed with a roof over it, Dennis said that Emma was very afraid to enter, even though it was well lit, that Emma was very afraid to enter into this makeshift walkway. And she put her hands out as if to feel for something, and didn't want to walk through it. So he continued staying with her and talking to her as much as he could. She was pretty non-responsive, he said. So after about an hour of time spent with her, he decided there was something seriously wrong. He ruled out drugs. I'm not sure what he based that on, but he said definitely I didn't think that she was stoned, that she was on drugs. He said I thought there was something else really wrong. So that's when he called. He didn't have a cell phone himself, so he stepped into a little restaurant on the corner and used their phone and called 911. And then he waited, watching her. He didn't go back to her. He didn't actually say it, but I think he didn't want her to associate him with having called the police, because he stayed across the street. He said, I kept an eye on her to make sure she didn't leave and to make sure the police did actually show up. But he didn't go back to her. He just watched from across the street and made sure that she was okay and waited till the police arrived. And when the police arrived, he left.
Okay. And now, could you tell me what you know about the police's involvement, like starting with the police arriving and ultimately leaving Emma there?
Well, I know little of what took place. I know a little bit more than apparently I'm supposed to know, because one of the police officers was a little more forthcoming. They arrived, I believe, there at about 7:17, and according to the police that I spoke to, the police officer I spoke to, they went through a list of questions that are customarily asked when they face a situation like this, when there's someone that seems in distress or is on the street, as Emma was. So they claim that they asked all the right questions in order to ascertain whether or not she was safe. I was told that they asked her questions such as, are you suicidal? Or do you feel that you're going to harm yourself? Do you feel that you're going to harm someone else? Have you eaten? Do you have a place to stay? And apparently she just nodded or shook her head, that she didn't actually speak. They spent about 45 minutes with her and determined that she was okay to be on her own out in on the streets of Victoria, barefoot in November, and they left her there. That was the last time anyone ever saw her.
Hey, it's Kate. Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
As the two Victoria police officers leave the scene and leave Emma still standing in front of the Empress Hotel, there would never be another confirmed sighting of her. What Emma said to police, or what led to their decision to not intervene, is unknown. Despite her great effort, Shelley has been unable to access detailed information from a police report. And in another cruel twist in the story, when you compare Shelley's timeline with that of Emma's on November 28th, you will see that Shelley's flight arrived just 3 hours after Emma was questioned by Victoria Police. And now, with a basic timeline of Emma's last day discussed, our conversation will move to discussing some leads Shelley happened upon and some persons of interest that came to the surface. Just like our discussion of Emma's activity on November 28th, we'll begin discussing the leads by starting off with that same prepaid credit card that Emma purchased the morning of her disappearance. It turns out, in the weeks after Emma's disappearance, a man was arrested after attempting to use the card to buy cigarettes.
The first lead I'd like you to hear you discuss is the prepaid credit card that Emma had purchased prior to her disappearance. Can you just tell me about how it turned up and what came of that lead ultimately?
Okay. Again, this is somewhat of a bizarre story, and I have conflicting stories. I was told by the police that the card was found on the side of the road by a man who went into, I believe, a gas station and used it to buy cigarettes. Now, the police gave me a very specific location as to where this card had been found, that this gentleman had apparently told them exactly where he had found the card. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I believe it was in Langford, but it was outside of Victoria, not in the city of Victoria. And this is what the police had told me, and that was on December 5th that he used the card. When he actually found it, I'm not sure, but he used it on December 5th. You can imagine my elation when I found out that the card had been used. I assumed it had been used by Emma. I was ecstatic until I found out that it was somebody else. But what's really, really odd about this part of the puzzle, Jordan, is that the person who found the card's name is Mike, and Mike phoned me. Mike actually phoned me. And he phoned me on three different occasions. And the first time he called, he could barely speak. He said, "I'm just really scared. I'm really nervous to be calling you, to be talking to you. I don't know if I should be. So all I'm going to do is just let you know that I'm Mike and I'm the person who found the card." Second time he calls, we have a similar conversation, only he says a little bit more, but again, not divulging any actual information, except that he said, "What the police have told you about where I found the card is not true. That's not where I found the card." Third conversation, he says to me, "I'm a recovering alcoholic. I don't know where I found the card." I said, "Mike, the police gave me a specific location." He said, "Well, I don't know why they gave you a specific location, because I don't even know where I found it." So I found that very puzzling, very bizarre. Your natural instinct would be to believe the police. Yes, this man's a recovering alcoholic. You could tell he was extremely shaky, extremely nervous talking to me. But to go out of his way to make three phone calls to me to tell me that card was not where the police claimed it to be, I just found that a very strange thing to have happen.
And as far as this man using the card, I'm assuming he was investigated in some way?
Yes, he was investigated. I believe he was polygraphed, and he was cleared.
During your search for Emma, one of the things that came into play was her extensive journals. Now, I understand you use them to try to understand her activities leading up to her disappearance. Can you talk about her journaling as well as what insight you gained from the journals?
Her journals, Emma's journals were many. They were numerous. Emma was a very prolific writer. She had thousands of pages of journaling, of writing, short stories, all kinds of things, poems. They were all very cryptic. They were all written very poetically. It was very hard to really understand what her intention was in some of her writings. Her actual, her physical, her penmanship, her manuscript writing was an art form in itself, so very, very difficult to get through these hundreds and thousands of pages. But what I gained from reading her journals was that my assumption based on what I read into them was that she was not well emotionally. There were a lot of things that she said in her journals that indicated to me that she was really not well, that she had perhaps had an emotional, psychological breakdown.
Now, one of the things that came up specifically in the Finding Emma documentary that Fifth Estate created was the idea that one particular piece of writing may possibly be a suicide note. Can you just not describe the writing, but describe your thoughts on that writing and what you think of the theory that that could be a suicide note?
Well, when I first came across it, I panicked and assumed it was a suicide note. But then after I read it a couple of times, I thought, I don't know so much that it's a suicide note as a last will and testament, which does not indicate suicide. I think she just wanted to be sure that certain people received certain things that were precious to her. I was really torn on that, Jordan. I mean, it says, you know, from dead Emma, which is an odd approach. But I wouldn't say, I didn't carry that in my heart as a suicide note. At first it startled me and it scared me, but I didn't carry that around in my heart, and I don't now as a suicide note. I think it was intended more to be a last will and testament or future reference. And a lot of young people nowadays actually do, and I've urged my other children to have living wills, because you don't know, you know. So I don't feel at this point, I don't feel that it was a suicide note.
To everyone from Dead Emma. Hello. I figure someone will be on this computer at some point and will read this. Okay, so I'm dead, floating about on energy or not, watching dying stars, reviving stars, dreaming milky dreams and shadow dancing on your timelines or whatever. Good luck, every heart. I love you. M.
Now, knowing all that you do now, can you talk about your opinion on Emma's mental health in leading up to her disappearance? And aside from her journals, maybe give me an idea of what led you to this conclusion.
Well, aside from the journals, I was able to get a great deal of information, actually, from Sandy Merriman Woman's Shelter. I was relentless. I went back over, and as I said, I went back over and over again until I was told to cease and desist. And they described some pretty bizarre behaviors. And they said that the behaviors had started roughly 2 weeks prior to the phone calls starting, the phone calls to me starting. And they weren't specific in their description of how she had changed, but they said she has changed dramatically. She is no longer the Emma we knew. There was an Emma, and now there's a new Emma. And she is not at all. She carries no similarities to the Emma we know. They describe things like her moving furniture out of the shelter onto the lawn. They would move it back in, and a couple of days later she would move it out onto the sidewalk. Eventually she moved some of the furniture onto the courthouse steps, all the while telling the staff members that there were voices, that the furniture was talking and saying things and bothering her, and she needed to get rid of it. They described at one point that they had actually become afraid of her. Now, to be afraid of Emma is unheard of. It was such a startling comment. I said, in what way? They said, well, she just wasn't herself. She was just acting so odd that we didn't want to turn our backs on her. I asked if she had shown any signs of violent behavior, and they said, oh, no, none at all. But yet, they said that they had become afraid of her, and that was definitely not the case about 2 weeks prior to that. So based on that, those descriptions of Emma's behavior, I think Emma became paranoid schizophrenic. Became a paranoid schizophrenic. I think that explains her paranoid behavior at the 7-Eleven. I think it explains her paranoid behavior, not wanting to walk to the construction site. I think she had a break with reality.
Now, as your search went on and the leads began to dry up, can you tell me about your mindset and discuss your decision to return home to Ontario after your roughly 2 months in Victoria?
Well, I wasn't prepared to come home, to be honest, but my family really urged me to. They were very concerned about Emma, of course, but they were also becoming very concerned about me and my state of mind. So I set a date. I decided that Emma had promised Redfish Bluefish that she would return to work on February 1st, which was, they were a seasonal restaurant, which was the date that they had set to open, and she had promised that she would return to work. So I thought, well, I'm going to wait and see if she does show up for work, in which case I'll stay around. And if she doesn't show up for work, then I guess I will listen to my family and come home. Because, I mean, I had a son who was, and he was an older teenager, but he was living alone in the house, worried sick about his sister, worried sick about his mother, and he was living alone because my husband and I had separated. So he was in this big empty house trying to take care of the three dogs and the three cats and go to school and go to work and stay positive and stay strong. So my oldest daughter and my ex-husband convinced me that I really needed to come home because of those reasons. So it was very difficult for me, Jordan. I felt like I was leaving her behind. And but I felt that their reasoning was valid. So I came back to Ontario.
Despite Shelley ending her boots-on-the-ground search in Victoria, from her home in Ontario, she continued her search for Emma. During her time in Victoria, Shelley had relied on the local press to share her story and to drum up interest in the search for Emma. But at this point in Shelley's search, from home in Ontario, she took this technique to a new level. Anyone who's been following Emma Philipoff's case is well aware of the CBC-produced Fifth Estate documentary titled Finding Emma. This was yet another vehicle of awareness Shelley used. I asked Shelley for a behind-the-scenes look at how this production came together. In your post-Victoria search, so with you now back in Ontario, you petitioned CBC to cover Emma's case. Can you describe the steps in getting them interested and getting the documentary made?
Well, it was much less complicated than I had anticipated. What I did was, I have a friend who works for CBC Radio in Fredericton, and I spoke to her and I said, you know, I've got to get the story out, and I've got to get it out in a big way. I'm thinking of the Fifth Estate or W5. And she said, well, I would go with Fifth Estate. She said, if I were you, I would write to Lyndon McIntyre. She said he's the most compassionate of the interviewers, of the journalists on the show. He is probably your best bet to maybe kind of win over and have him become interested in the story. So what I did, Jordan, was I just sat down and I wrote Lyndon McIntyre an email. And I tried to make it as simple, as straightforward, and as compassionate and as urgent as I could. And I think it was within a day, he's in flight from somewhere, flying into Toronto, and he responds to me, and he says, I'm just arriving in Toronto from a trip, just give me a couple of days, and I'll be back in touch with you. And within a couple of days, sure enough, he was in touch with me, and he said, I'm more than interested in your story, and let's do it. And it was that simple. It was that simple. And I asked him why he was so quickly willing to do a story on Emma. And he said there was just something. And I think it's because I described Emma. And nobody can turn Emma down. I think he was drawn to her and wanted that story out. And that's how simple it was. And then from there on, we worked on, it wasn't Lyndon that actually, it was Mark Kelly, who was the journalist that actually did the work. But originally it was supposed to be Lyndon McIntyre, and he did a lot of the footwork ahead of time. And he pushed it through. He pushed it through CBC and got it on the Fifth Estate.
In the documentary Finding Emma, there seemed to be some suspicions directed towards Julian, the friend of Emma, who was said to have exhibited some stalking behavior. Just with a brief summary, can you just tell me a little bit about what made Julian seem like he could potentially have been involved in her disappearance?
Well, to be honest, there are only a couple of things that really would lead someone to think of Julian as a possible suspect in some way. The fact that he moved to Victoria a while after Emma had moved there struck a lot of people, including myself, as very suspicious. He said he just arbitrarily picked a city on the west coast, and then he just arbitrarily picked Victoria, and what a surprise to find Emma there. Well, it seems like an awful big coincidence to me. So that was the first thing that kind of alerted people to the fact that something didn't seem quite right. I mean, with all the places on the west coast that he could have chosen, that he chose. I mean, Victoria's a small city. You know, if it had been Vancouver, you know, well, maybe. But, I mean, Victoria, I mean, it's a little island. So that was something that drew suspicion. And then we later on discover Facebook messages that he had sent to my ex-husband trying to track Emma down, and in which he himself uses the word stalker. He said, I want to apologize for having stalked your daughter. That was kind of alarming. So those were the two main reasons that Julie never came into play or he never became a suspicious character. And then I must admit that I found it odd that he was so quick to track me down. I mean, how he knew I was in the city, I'm not quite sure. I don't know if there had been media coverage yet at that point, but he tracked me down very, very quickly, and he had never met me. And I was in the library on one of the computers because I knew that Emma spent a lot of time there, so I thought, I'm going to sit at a computer station, and I can see the front door, so I can watch for Emma to come in. And I noticed this young man staring at me. And finally, I got up and went over, and I said, do you know me? Do I know you? Can I help you? And then he went on to introduce himself and explain who he was. And I found that odd, Jordan. I found that odd that he had spent enough time looking at my Facebook page to be able to pick me out of a fairly large group of people sitting at computer stations, having never met me, in a city where you wouldn't expect to see me. I found that a little bit odd.
So now the next thing I'm going to ask you about is the two leads that came from the Fifth Estate documentary. So that being the photo of the girl at the coffee shop and the green shirt guy. So could you just describe both of those leads and just tell me what came of them?
Well, the photo of the girl in the coffee shop was absolutely overwhelming. It was a better likeness of Emma than some of the photos that we had of her, because I'm sure you've noticed that she's almost chameleon-like, that she is different looking at every single photo of her. You know, she changes her hair, she cuts her bangs, she puts her hair on the side, she puts her hair up, she changes her dress style, whatever, and suddenly Emma looks like a completely different person. That person of that young woman in the coffee shop actually looked more like Emma than some of the pictures that we actually had of Emma. It was just, when I saw that, I thought, we found Emma. We found Emma, that's her. Didn't look like what she would wear, but I thought, we found her. And I took the picture to my ex-husband and showed him, and he said, well, that's Emma. And he's an artist. I mean, he has an artist's eye. And he said, yeah, that's Emma. So then I put up on Facebook with the person, blah, 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 in the person in the photograph sitting at the coffee shop and, you know, dated and all that. If you know who this person is, would you please come forward? And within a couple of days, someone got a hold of me and gave me the name of the person in the photograph. And I asked that they put me in touch with her. And she assured me that it was her, and she sent me a number of photographs of herself. Now, oddly enough, she didn't look like Emma in any of them except for one. It required a profile picture for her to look like Emma. But it was really, really demoralizing because it looked so much like Emma that we thought it was Emma. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now the other lead, and one that's still talked about all the time, is the green shirt guy. Could you just describe who he is and how this played out?
Okay, the green shirt guy. The green shirt guy haunts me. We call him the green shirt guy for lack of a better name because he had a green t-shirt on. He walked into a store in Vancouver, a store called Blitz. And it was a clothing novelty type store. And in his hand, he was crumpling up a poster, a missing poster of Emma. And angry. He had an angry walk about him, and he had anger in his voice. And he said to the owner, one of the owners who was at the cash register, he says, this is, I forget the exact words he used, but he said, this woman's not missing. Emma's not missing. Emma's my girlfriend, and she's not missing. She just doesn't want to have anything to do with her family, and crumpled it up and just threw it onto the counter at the cash. And then he proceeded to wander through the store, and he held out a piece of clothing and said, oh, this would fit Emma. Emma's really small. This would fit her. And then he turned around and walked out. They immediately called 911. Unfortunately, 911 took their sweet time getting to the store, and by then the green shirt guy had long disappeared. He was long gone. So we've had him up on Facebook. We've done all kinds of things to try to track him down, and nobody has come forward willing to identify him. It's been suggested that we get a picture of him and post to Vancouver with his face, but I'm not sure of the legality of that. So we haven't done that, but nobody has come forward. And yet he's quite distinctive looking. You know, I'm pretty sure I would recognize him. But he was angry. He was angry just that there was this missing poster of his supposed girlfriend, and that in fact that she just wanted to be left alone. She just didn't want to have any interaction. She didn't want to have anything to do with her family.
If you're still with me, thank you for joining Shelley and I on this heartbreaking ride through what can only be described as a parent's worst nightmare. What we had heard during the discussion was a basic telling of the events and factors that surround Emma Filipov's disappearance. And of course, all told from the perspective of Emma's mom, Shelley Filipov. At this point, we're left looking at a multi-level mystery. Of course, the big question is, where is Emma Filipov? But then, there are many secondary mysteries, like what was happening in Emma's life before her disappearance. Was her crisis related to mental health, or was there a real threat? Who is the green shirt guy? And what is up with Julian, the young man who moved to Victoria shortly after Emma did and was said to have exhibited stalking behavior? Now, these are some big and important questions, so this series has a lot of work to do. In the next episode, we'll take our next step towards understanding the case by unpacking the conversation we just heard between Shelley and I. In the next episode of Emma Filipov is Missing, we'll be joined by Tim and Lance, the hosts of the groundbreaking Missing Maura Murray podcast.
She was probably suffering from some kind of manic episode, some kind of psychotic break. But at the same time, I don't think you can discount abduction or murder or runaway for that matter. But that guy, Julian, I think really needs to be looked at more.
But he was looked into and he passed a polygraph test, right?
So was.
No. I agree. Yeah, exactly. When she's talking about how she's sitting there and she looks over and someone's staring at her, and she actually had to make the move to talk to him, as opposed to him walking over to her and saying, "Are you Emma's mother?"
And yet he recognized her out of the crowd.
And he said he recognized her.
From Facebook photos, I think is what she had said.
I mean, that's and when I saw his when I saw him on camera and he said, "Nope, that's an absolute coincidence." And everyone else is saying, "I don't believe in coincidences, especially when it's a missing person, a missing attractive female. Who do you always go to first?"
Yeah, the boyfriend or...
Boyfriend of the husband.
Yeah.
And with that, we will conclude this episode of the nighttime series, Emma Filipov is Missing. But before we wrap things up, I want to end with some thanks. A massive thank you goes out to Shelley Filipov for taking the time out of her day to speak with me and for being so open about what must be an unimaginably painful topic to discuss. Shelley, your dedication to your daughter is truly inspiring. I only hope that my coverage of this case brings more awareness of your family's plight and in turn creates more supporters and advocates. I'd also like to thank CBC's Mark Kelly and the team that created the Finding Emma documentary. For anyone who hasn't seen it, I've added a link to where you can watch it for free, as well as links to several other sites related to this episode in the show notes. Next, a big thank you to Vox Somnia and Paragon Cause for providing the musical and ambient themes for this series. And lastly, the biggest thanks of all goes out to everyone listening. Without you, the sun would have surely rose on nighttime years ago. And for anyone out there who wants nighttime, please consider supporting my Patreon campaign. For $1 a month, you can access the ad-free premium feed, which provides early releases of the episodes. And then for a couple dollars more, you can access the Nightcap After Show, in which I and a guest climb a bit further down the rabbit holes than what you'll hear in the main episodes. You can join my Patreon and access the supporter content by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And with that said, I'd like to thank the current patrons of the show and welcome some new members to the group. Jenna M. and Vincent B., I appreciate your generous support of Nighttime. And for anyone else who'd like to support the show but can't help financially, you can give me a big hand by telling your friends about me and by leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whichever equivalent you use. If any of you listening want to stay up to date with my activities on and off the show, follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I use the handle @NighttimePod. And if you have any story ideas or want to give feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. Now, until next time, take care of each other, hug your loved ones tight, and contact me on social media and let me know your theory on Emma Filipov's disappearance.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
Somebody somewhere knows something. She didn't just disappear. She couldn't just vanish. Somebody has to know something, Jordan. Somebody has to know something.
New on Showcase.
They call me the Christchurch Carver.
Based on the international bestseller.
This is trademark souvenir.
Can't stop thinking about the apple. Usually he eats it.
I've got a copycat on my hands.
I know who you are, Joe. I know what you do. You have 2 days to find a copycat.
This is way harder to make sense of when you didn't do it.
Dark City, The Cleaner. All new Wednesdays on Showcase. Stream on Stack TV.